Voice of America in Washington. This is VOA Global. Hi, I'm Jim Stevenson.
And hello from me. I'm Ira Melman. On today's program, we have the latest for you on the murder of hundreds of people, including many children in Pakistan.
What do you think about 3D printing? That's on today's Now feature.
In our report on education, we take a closer look at China's Confucius Institutes in the United States. And we take a closer look at the exoneration of an 18-year-old man who was executed 18 years ago for a rape and murder in Inner Mongolia.
That's with Sarah Williams and China Focus. Also, Ira will be back with us in the American Cafe for a closer look at computer hacking as well as a new treatment for an eye disease. All that coming up on VOA Global.
Stay with us, please.
You're listening to Daybreak Asia. Hello and welcome to our summary of Asian news and events for Wednesday, December 17th. I'm Jim Stevenson. In brief today, Islamist militants wearing military uniforms with explosives strapped to their bodies assaulted a military-run school in Pakistan on Tuesday, killing at least 141 people, most of them students. The Pakistani Taliban has claimed responsibility for the bloodshed, as we hear from Ayaz Gul in Islamabad.
The deaths came in a siege that lasted more than 8 hours after heavily armed Islamist militants in military uniforms assaulted the school in the northwestern city of Peshawar. Army spokesman Major General Asim Bajwa spoke to VOA after the rescue operation concluded.
There was a group of 7 terrorists who crossed over the fence from rear of the school, Army Public School on Warsik Road, and straight entered the auditorium, and as they entered in, they saw a huge gathering of students. They started shooting them indiscriminately. After that, the terrorists rushed towards other blocks of the school. But by then, the reaction forces had arrived, and they killed all 7 terrorists.
General Bajwa says 121 children and several staff members have been hospitalized, some of them in critical condition. He said security forces rescued around 1,000 students during the operation. Ehsan Mukhtar is a student at the school. He says as soon as the gunfire erupted, our teacher instructed everyone to move to a corner of the room and sit on the floor for safety. Mukhtar adds that an hour later, when intensity of the fire reduced, army soldiers arrived to rescue us, and on the way out, we saw bullet-ridden bodies of our schoolmates everywhere. The Pakistani Taliban claimed responsibility for the massacre, saying it was in retaliation for the army's offensive against militant sanctuaries in the country's northwestern tribal region near the Afghan border. Local and foreign fighters have long used the sanctuaries to stage attacks on both sides of the border. Bajwa says intelligence agencies have launched a wide-ranging investigation and have some leads, but he would not share further details. He says it appears the terrorists wanted to carry out a massacre, not take hostages. The general adds that there are reports of Arabic-speaking men among the attackers, but it is too early to say whether there were foreigners among them. Pakistani leaders condemned the bloodshed. Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif rushed to Peshawar. Mr. Sharif vows the army will continue its counter-militancy operations until terrorism is eliminated from Pakistan. He said the cowardly and barbaric act will not weaken the nation's resolve against terrorism. Much of the nation appeared to be shocked by the attack, with television stations running live broadcast of the rescue efforts and the aftermath. General Bajwa described a grim scene in the school.
As our soldiers arrived in, when they went in the auditorium, they described there were bodies of young children lying all over the floor, and they were soaked in blood. And it was a very, very sad description.
United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon condemned the attack and urged Pakistani authorities to make every effort to bring the perpetrators to justice.
I condemn this heinous act in the strongest possible terms. No cause can justify such a brutality.
Nobel Peace Prize winner Malala Yousafzai, a student and Pakistani education advocate who was shot by the Taliban 2 years ago, responded to Tuesday's carnage.
We stand with all those families and all those children who are injured right now and who are suffering through this big trauma. And now it is time that we unite, and I call upon the international community, leaders in Pakistan, all political parties and everyone, that we should stand up together and fight against terrorism.
U.S. President Barack Obama condemned the attack, saying by targeting students and teachers in this heinous attack, terrorists have once again shown their depravity. The Prime Minister of neighboring India telephoned Mr. Sharif to offer condolences. Prime Minister Sharif has convened a meeting of leaders of all political parties on Wednesday to discuss the attack. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Australian officials and members of the public are paying tribute to the victims of a deadly siege in Sydney, during which a lone gunman held 17 people hostage at a downtown cafe. A man and a woman were killed along with the armed Iranian refugee during the late-night clash. We hear more now from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
Australia Prime Minister Tony Abbott joined throngs of mourners Tuesday, laying flowers at a makeshift memorial in Sydney to the victims of Monday's cafe siege, which ended when police conducted a dramatic early morning raid to free the hostages. Two hostages and the gunman were killed in the shootout. While his motivations remain unclear, Australian police believe Monis was acting alone and wasn't part of a broader Islamist plot. Muslim groups here have moved quickly to distance themselves from the hostage taker, stressing that they share the shock and horror felt across Australia. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
A two-day meeting in Laos over the construction of a 260-megawatt dam on the lower Mekong River has left officials and the environmental communities deeply polarized. Ron Corbin reports for VOA from Bangkok that the Lao government remains determined to press ahead with the project, dismissing concerns despite fears over the dam's impact on the Mekong Delta region.
The planned 260-megawatt Don Sahong hydropower dam in southern Champasak province is one of nine for the Mekong River's main stream in Laos, or near the Lao-Thai border. Laos is heavily dependent on income from some 10 hydropower plants, largely built since the 1990s on tributaries and rivers within Laos. They generate some 2,000 megawatts of power for domestic use and for export to Thailand. But two new massive dams have stoked controversy. One, the $3.8 billion Ayaberry Dam in northern Laos, and the $600 million Don Sahong plan for the Siphondon Kone Falls in Champasak province, have drawn scrutiny from environmentalists who worry about their impact on migratory fish and water flow. Laos Vice Minister of Energy and Mines, Virapon Virapong, says the government is committed to what he terms developing clean, renewable hydropower despite criticisms. Downstream, Vietnam has raised alarms over the impact the Don Sahong project would have on the Mekong Delta, the country's rice bowl and home to 20 million people. Vietnam says the dam will result in increasing water salinity and soil erosion. An MRC spokesman told VOA national consultations are set to be held in Vietnam, Thailand and Cambodia before final decisions are made on the project. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Daybreak Asia comes to you every weekday on VOA Global. It's a podcast as well. You can subscribe to it for free at voanews.com.
You're in tune with VOA Global. If you're not in tune with it, you're listening to us streaming on somewhere, and we'd like to tell you that that's where you should listen to us as well. Also, you could tell us what you think about certain stories. The big story of today, Jim?
Of course, the Taliban attack on the Pakistani school. The siege of a school in Pakistan by Taliban militants has ended, leaving at least 141 people dead, most of them students. We had many comments on this story.
Coffin Taras from Warren, Ohio says, this is the last straw. Pakistan must find a way to stop these Taliban savages, these killers of innocent students. They should all be immediately sought out along with their supporters. If violence is what these savages understand, then violence violence is what shall come to their doorstep, and with all of the fury Pakistan can muster.
Hakeem Khan from Afghanistan writes, this kind of action, either in revenge or intentional, is not accepted. It is not accepted in our religion, Islam, to kill children, and it's not good for the military forces of Pakistan to shoot civilian homes and children, because Pakistani forces demolishes civilian property. Also, Pakistan should not interfere in Afghanistan affairs.
Story from Australia. From yesterday, Australian officials and members of the public are paying tribute to the victims of a deadly siege in Sydney, during which a lone gunman held 17 people hostage at a downtown cafe. Matt from St. Louis says, what do we have to do to get these criminals to follow the law? This guy was Iranian, so maybe he wasn't aware of the fact you aren't supposed to have guns in Oz.
Well, Merlin Wizard is from planet Earth, and he writes, only evolution and eventually rid the planet of faith derived abhorrence, not words. Thank you, Merlin Wizard. If you'd like to write to us, you may at voaasia@voanews.com.
This is VOA Global from the Voice of America. Coming up on our program today, by the way, with Jim Stevenson, I'm Ira Melman. We have to keep telling you that
so you actually
know who we are. Because you
so
can't
we can
see
remember
us
who we are.
That's sometimes very challenging. But nevertheless, I have an education report coming up, and it's the continuing controversy over the Confucius Institutes from China that are in the United States. And that's coming up momentarily right here on VOA Global from the Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman with Report on Education. U.S. lawmakers are investigating whether academic freedom is being threatened at American universities building campuses in China and partnering with the Chinese on Confucius Institutes. The chairman of a House subcommittee focusing on human rights said earlier this month that he will seek a governmental accountability office study of agreements between U.S. universities and China that allow China to promote its culture and language here through education programs it supervises and finances. This past summer, I talked with some people involved in the conversation. The move against the Chinese-sponsored institute system stems at least in part from a magazine article published last year written by Marshall Salins, professor emeritus of archaeology at the University of Chicago. Salins told us that in addition to teaching the Chinese language and culture as espoused in its literature, the Confucius Institutes are also interested in power. He terms it soft power.
And it's under the control of an organization in China called Hanban, which itself is under the governance of a governing council that consists of a chair who's a head, a chair who's a member of the Politburo, and vice chairs who will hold important ministries and high official positions in the government, which checks the annual agenda of the Confucius Institute and receives the reports.
Salins contends the delivery of this agenda are the Confucius teachers who are selected, paid, and placed in the institutes by Hanban.
Teachers are sent out by Hanban, selected according to Hanban criteria, which includes a requirement of so-called political thinking, which is to say that the teachers have to be vetted according to Chinese rules about political correctness.
Which Salin says includes steering clear of conversations about prohibited topics such as Tibet, the Dalai Lama, and Tiananmen Square. Salin says many of the textbooks, also supplied by China, are less than objective, with one of the history texts detailing how U.S. aggression started the war in Korea. One of the oldest Confucius Institutes is on the campus of the University of Maryland.
I've just not seen some of the things that other people are talking about. And it could be that it's because we have negotiated and we have grown and we have changed it in ways that match what we want to accomplish on our campus.
Donna Weissman is the director of the Confucius Institute at the University of Maryland, as well as being the dean of that school's College of Education.
Hanban in China has established a program for campuses across the world, not just in the United States and Canada, but across the world, to really promote Chinese language learning and also culture, understanding of culture. And they really do have a very narrow focus of language learning and culture.
As is most often the case when dealing with controversial issues, there is a middle ground. Terry Bogalke directs the education program at Hawaii's East-West Institute.
I think that by and large that they're doing some good work in providing opportunity for Chinese language study. On the other hand, I think that there isn't the kind of openness in exploring cultural, social kinds of issues. I think reflecting in many respects the reluctance of the Chinese government to perhaps open issues that could become controversial.
I'm Ira Melman with Report on Education. You can hear the reports on air and online at voanews.com and various podcast platforms.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. A Chinese court has found an 18-year-old man innocent of the rape and murder of a woman in Inner Mongolia 18 years after he was executed. Huga Chilatu was arrested in 1996 after he attempted to help the woman who had been attacked in a public toilet. Authorities convicted him of the crime and executed him. But the official Xinhua News Agency said in 2005, another man, a serial rapist, admitted to the murder. Sophie Richardson is China director at Human Rights Watch. She spoke with me about this case, which was retried last month.
Well, I think keeping it from being simply an absolute travesty of justice requires that Chinese judicial authorities look at all of the other possible cases that might have had similar pathologies. To put it a different way, it's encouraging that they're reexamining this particular case, even if it means coming to an awful conclusion. But the kinds of abuses that contributed to this outcome are likely present in hundreds, if not thousands, more cases. And so if we're going to ensure that innocent people aren't executed, we need to see some fundamental changes very quickly in the Chinese judicial system.
What changes would you like to see?
Well, first of all, the Chinese government has to live up to its repeatedly issued regulations to exclude from court confessions obtained through torture, which is what happened to this young man. He was suspected of having carried out this murder. There was no evidence to suggest this. He was tortured to confess. He confessed. He was prosecuted on the basis of that. Torture in pretrial detention and criminal cases in China is endemic. And regularly, we see that judges don't exclude the evidence that should be excluded, that the onus is on the defense to prove that they were tortured, which is very difficult to do, and that very few of the procedural protections that have been put in place, for example, videotaping confessions, ensuring that people are only held in proper detention centers. You know, we've seen repeatedly that police sidestep those protections so that they can torture people into confessing. And that has to change.
And in this case, it's especially tragic because this young man apparently went to help this
yes.
woman, heard her crying, and then he was then accused of authorities of doing this.
Precisely, and then executed for essentially having tried to do the right thing. I mean, everything that could possibly go wrong in the Chinese judicial system has gone wrong in this particular case. And we're concerned that all of these same problems are highly likely in many other similar cases. And so, you know, while it is, you know, it's encouraging to see the uproar amongst ordinary citizens in China, and hopefully that will push authorities to be more careful about how basic criminal procedure is followed, especially in capital cases.
It's also very sad reading about this man's parents thinking about what they must have gone through and hearing this at this point. I mean, is there any way that they can get, you know, what would their situation be like now under Chinese law? Can they get anything out of this?
In principle, people, they are entitled to a certain level of compensation. I have no idea whether that's what they actually want. Presumably, that which they want the most is impossible, which is, you know, having their son back. Whether they want to become, you know, figureheads or part of a campaign to stop these kinds of abuses in the future, I think remains to be seen. One can only imagine how incredibly traumatized they are. They've also been fighting for 8 years now to get the judicial authorities to retry the case. You know, and that's a long time for a fight like this, which will have involved, you know, irking a lot of local authorities, which will presumably have made, you know, their lives beyond this case difficult as well.
Could a case like this, if something similar happened, would local authorities and officials, would it maybe encourage them to act differently?
Well, only if they are held accountable for all of their mistakes. In this case, our information is that some of the police, the procuratorate staff, and one of the judges involved have actually all been promoted according to schedule, even despite their mishandling of these cases.
Sophie Richardson, China director at Human Rights Watch. On Weibo, social media users question whether the staff involved could be charged in the case. Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
This is the Voice of America from Washington. Along with Jim Stevenson, I'm Ira Melman. We take a look at Asia business news. Asian markets finished mixed today. The Shanghai Composite gained 2.31%, while the Nikkei 225 led the Hang Seng lower. They fell 2.01% and 1.55%, respectively.
China is looking to secure business ties and increase political influence by launching a charm offensive in Eastern Europe, where the European Union and Russia are also vying for sway. Chinese Prime Minister Li Keqiang, accompanied by 200 corporate executives, met the leaders of 16 Central and Eastern European countries Tuesday for a two-day summit being billed in China as an opportunity to deepen ties to the region and boost relations with the European Union.
China Tuesday raised its official estimate of last year's gross domestic product, possibly moving closer to passing the United States as the biggest economy. No indication the change would affect official policy, but a higher output might help to reassure Chinese leaders who are trying to transform a slowing economy and reduce reliance on trade and investment.
Well, there's still more reaction on that nut rage cover-up. South Korea's transport ministry said Korean Airlines will face sanctions for pressuring employees to lie during a government probe into the nut rage fiasco that highlighted the tyrannical behavior of a top Korean business family. The ministry said Tuesday it will also evaluate if the airline's corporate culture poses safety risks after its chairman's daughter overruled the captain of a flight to force the plane back to the gate in the incident earlier this month.
Yeah, it's more than a corporate culture. It's a family culture, apparently, with Korean Airlines. And that is a look at Asia business from the Voice of America. Tune in every day, well, 5 days a week, for the latest from Asia.
This is Today in History. On December 17th, 497 BC, the first Saturnalia festival was celebrated in ancient Rome. The festival, leading up to the winter solstice, involved gift-giving and may have had some influence on the modern celebrations of Christmas and New Year's. In 1830, South American liberator Simón Bolívar died. Bolívar played a key role in Latin America's struggle for independence from Spain. On this day in 1843, the holiday classic A Christmas Carol by English author Charles Dickens was published. In 1903, near Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, bicycle manufacturers Orville and Wilbur Wright of Dayton, Ohio, completed the first successful controlled powered flight of a heavier-than-air craft. The plane flew 39 meters in just 12 seconds. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
This is VOA Global from the Voice of America. They're going nuts in Hawaii, Jim.
They are. You know, that macadamia story we told you about with Korean Airlines has actually been pretty big in Hawaii. It's made a boost in the sale of macadamia nuts.
All you need is just some kind of publicity whatsoever. You know, the story of the daughter of the guy who runs Korea Airlines, Korea Air, and she is the big mahaf, whatever, and she brought a plane back to the terminal in the United States because her macadamia nuts were served in a bag rather than on a plate.
Yeah.
She wanted it on a plate.
Well, the Hawaiians like it, though. You know, there are over 700 macadamia nut farms and 8 processing plants there.
You tell me something I don't know every day. You realize that?
I didn't know it either.
International
but we'll
edition.
Hear more.
Yeah. Michael Lippman is next with International Edition.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. Coming up, Pakistan holds its first funerals for victims of a school massacre by Taliban militants. A Yemeni school bus is hit in another attack by Islamist extremists. And Russia's ruble sinks to a new low against the dollar despite central bank intervention. I'm Michael Lippin. Pakistanis have held their first funerals for victims of a Taliban school massacre that left at least 141 people dead, most of them young students. The Islamist assailants attacked the Pakistani military-run school facility in the northwestern city of Peshawar, shooting children and adults. Officials said 132 of the dead were students aged 12 to 16 years old. 9 staff members also were killed. VOA's Jeff Custer has more.
Islamist militants wearing military uniforms and strapped with explosives attacked the military-run facility Tuesday, leaving scores of people dead and wounded, most of them students. An army spokesman said security forces killed 6 of the attackers. Speaking on national television, Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif condemned the assault, calling it a national tragedy, and vowed to continue military operations against the militants.
The government and the army has begun Operation Zarb-e-Azb against the militants, and the results are good. As you are seeing, and this operation will continue until we banish this terrorism from our country. And also, we are in contact with the Afghan government to fight together against this terrorism.
The Pakistani Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack, saying it was in retaliation for Pakistan's offensive targeting militants in the country's northwestern tribal regions near the Afghan border. From his hospital bed, a wounded student described the attack.
Today we had a chemistry paper exam. As I finished my paper and I was sitting inside the lab, firing started. As the firing started, militants entered and opened fire on all of the students.
Speaking from London, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry called the attack devastating and pledged U.S. support to Pakistan. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
In Yemen, 2 car bombs have exploded south of the capital Sana'a, hitting a school bus and killing 25 people, including at least 15 students. Sources said Tuesday's attack in the Rada area of the central province of Al-Bayda targeted the home of a leader of Shiite rebels known as Houthis. They said the school bus was traveling near the rebel leader's home at the time. It was not clear how many Shiite rebels were also killed in the bombings. The Yemeni sources blamed the attack on al-Qaeda militants who have engaged in fierce fighting with the Houthis in Rada in recent months. The Ugandan army says almost 1,000 Congolese M23 rebels have escaped from a camp just before their scheduled repatriation to the Democratic Republic of Congo. A Ugandan military spokesperson said the Congolese fighters wanted to avoid returning to the DRC because they were afraid for their security. The spokesman said the Ugandan government was looking for the escaped rebels. Earlier, a civilian representative of the M23 group said the fighters fled the Ugandan camp on Tuesday as trucks arrived to take them to an airbase from which they were to have been airlifted to the DRC. The M23 representative said some of the fighters were shot and wounded during their escape. A group of M23 fighters ended up in Uganda last year after the Congolese army drove them from their strongholds in Congo's North Kivu province. Well, the White House says President Barack Obama has decided to sign legislation authorizing more sanctions on Russia for its role in Ukraine's rebellion by pro-Russian separatists. The U.S. legislation, which cleared the Senate last week, also gives Mr. Obama the authority to provide $350 million in military aid to the Ukrainian government, which has been fighting the Moscow-backed rebels. The measure will enable the United States to supply anti-tank weapons, munitions, and surveillance drones to Kyiv. It also requires the president to impose new sanctions on Russia's defense and energy sectors if Russian firms sell or transfer military equipment to Ukraine, Georgia, Moldova, or Syria. But the U.S. legislation does not make it mandatory for Mr. Obama to either impose the sanctions or transfer the aid. Well, the value of Russia's currency, the ruble, has dropped 20% in a single day, touching a new low of 80 to the dollar. Earlier, the Russian central bank had tried to stop that decline by ordering a dramatic increase in interest rates. VOA's Daniel Scharf has the details.
Russia's central bank announced the jump to a 17% rate overnight Monday to try to shore up the currency after it lost 10% of its value in just one day. Igor Nikolaev is director of strategic analysis at the audit consulting company FBK in Moscow.
Важное решение, но оно не способно переломить ситуацию.
He says the interest rate increase would not change the situation because the reasons for such a fall of the ruble are much more serious and fundamental. He says this is what happens with oil prices now. This is macroeconomic weakness, he says, or the weakness of the Russian economy itself. This is also the effect of sanctions beginning to become significant. Falling oil prices and Western sanctions for the Kremlin's actions in Ukraine have slowly been hammering away at the Russian economy. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Moscow.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says nothing should be allowed to get in the way of Israel's upcoming elections, as Palestinians prepare to introduce a draft U.N. Security Council resolution that would set a deadline for Israel's withdrawal from territories claimed by the Palestinians. In comments to reporters ahead of his Tuesday meeting with Chief Palestinian Negotiator Saeb Erekat in London, Kerry said it's important to lower tensions so that there's an opportunity to find a path toward genuine peace.
We all know the risk of escalation is constant and it's real. And that is why it is imperative to lower the temperature and the tension so that we have an opportunity to find a path.
Well, Kerry said the United States has made no determination about support for any possible UN resolution regarding Palestinian statehood. 10 former high-ranking Bosnian Serb officials were arrested on Tuesday on suspicion of killing dozens of Muslim civilians at the start of the 1992-95 Bosnian War. Police in Bosnia on Tuesday arrested the former military and police officials during raids at several locations in the northeastern part of the country. The men are accused of planning, leading, and participating in a July 1992 operation in which 120 civilians, including women and children, were expelled from their homes in the northeastern village of Lokanj. 67 of them were later shot dead. More than 100,000 people were killed in the Bosnian War, while another 2 million became refugees. Well, that's your latest look at the international headlines on The Voice of America. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington.
A look at business on VOA Global. Jim Stevenson along with Ira Melman. The U.S. stock market suffered big swings in opposite directions amid high volume Tuesday, ending the day at session lows. Analysts pointed to fluctuations in the dollar and the oil price as the culprits for wild swings on Wall Street. Oil prices began the day with a big loss, only to settle roughly flat. The S&P 500 ended 17 points lower to settle at 1972, recording more than a 2% drop from top to bottom Tuesday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 112 points, or about 0.7%, to close at 17069. The Nasdaq Composite ended the day with a loss of 57 points, or 1.2%. Its index sitting at 45.47 as technology stocks sold off.
The Russian ruble came under intense selling pressure Tuesday, falling at one point by a catastrophic 20% to a new historic low. That despite massive pre-dawn interest rate hikes from Russia's central bank. Russian officials were clearly rattled, even though state television urged citizens not to panic. The deputy central bank chairman said the situation is critical. He said we could not have imagined what is happening in our worst dreams. Central bank's surprise decision to raise the interest rate to 17% from 10.5% in the middle of the night Tuesday appeared to be a desperate attempt to prop up the troubled currency.
Well, also in trouble, Apple's online store is now down in Russia. It's yet another sign that the ruble's downward spiral has far-reaching effects. The company said that due to extreme fluctuations in the value of the currency, the online store is unavailable while Apple reviews its product pricing.
Make sure you stay with us on a daily basis for our program, VOA Global, to hear the daily business report from the VOA.
This is the Voice of America, and we are VOA Global. Jim Stevenson with Ira Melman. Coming up, we hear from David Byrd, and now, where he'll be talking about 3D printing. You've heard about that, where you can tell a printer to make up something that's actually three-dimensional, just about anything these days.
They're even working, apparently, on hearts and things
that.
Oh, yes. Yeah, also American Cafe coming up in just a moment. I think you'll enjoy some news on technology. Enjoy. I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Hacking has been in the news quite a bit of late. There is the hacking of the Sony Corporation. Also in September, information networks of two U.S. government agencies were attacked by hackers based abroad, but officials did not report the incidents until late October. VOA's George Putich is in the cafe with more.
Hackers are constantly probing U.S. government agencies trying to find out what sort of data is accessible. The White House and more recently the State Department have also reported attacks on unclassified parts of their systems that were quickly contained. But the incidents point to the vulnerability of the government's vital networks. Finding out whether the government is doing enough to protect its networks is as hard as finding out who is behind these and other similar attacks, says LaSalle University adjunct professor of information security Dean Henry. The Philadelphia cybersecurity consultant says vulnerability opens when people forget what he calls basic cybersecurity hygiene.
Not only in the federal government, but in general, people are tending to enable these attacks by clicking on links or visiting websites that have malware attached to them, and thereby opening a door for an attacker.
Henry says U.S. internet security also suffers from a shortage of cybersecurity experts.
I think the root cause of the shortage may be lying with undergraduate education and also basically schools where the STEM skills, science, technology, engineering, and math skills aren't being taught in volume enough, or students aren't being attracted to them enough to feed that pipeline.
Henry says fighting cyber attacks is a never-ending battle, and everybody must be aware of those threats.
It's not just the federal government or corporate America. It really gets down to individuals and doing really basic things, as basic as changing passwords, using difficult passwords, not having passwords the same on different sites. It's basic security awareness and training for everyone.
He says the best protection from cyber attacks are long, complex, and frequently changed passwords. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
A new study using laboratory mice points to the mechanism behind a leading cause of blindness. Health reporter Art Chimes says the research also points to a possible treatment.
The World Health Organization has listed glaucoma as the second leading cause of blindness behind cataracts. Drugs and surgery can sometimes help, but better treatments could make a difference. In glaucoma, a buildup of pressure in the eye can lead to damage to the optic nerve and loss of sight. Dr. Susan Quaggan of Northwestern University in Chicago explains that the eye is full of fluid and is making new fluid all the time.
And you can imagine when you're making this fluid, it's just as important that you have a proper drainage system so the fluid can escape. And if there's a problem with this drainage system, the fluid will build up and this results in increased pressure.
Quaggan and her colleagues identified a specific chemical signal or pathway in the body that's essential for a healthy drainage system to develop. Mice that were genetically modified to block that chemical signal quickly showed signs of glaucoma.
Without this pathway, the drainage system doesn't develop, the pressure builds up, and glaucoma develops.
Quaggan says her lab now is a target for a medicine that might help.
Ultimately, what we're trying to do is to develop an eye drop, a simple eye drop that we could give to patients that will actually activate this pathway. So giving back the building blocks for these drainage vessels in the eye to improve drainage and to reduce pressure and to prevent blindness.
This is Art Chimes reporting.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. This is your invitation to join us daily at voanews.com, where we welcome your comments and your story suggestions.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. You know, 3D printing has been used to make all kinds of things. Architectural models, toys, tools, even firearms. But now, it can help surgeons fix heart problems by making an exact replica of a diseased heart so they can look at the problem before they operate. Roseanne Skirbel tells us more.
Surgeons routinely use digital images to explore the heart in minute detail. But no two human hearts are alike, which led Matthew Bramlett to create an exact heart replica from those images. The University of Illinois College of Medicine pediatric cardiologist says the 3D replica uncovers information to guide surgery.
Even when, you know, I will take the MRI and render the images, even a heart that's printing or that's, you know, sort of spinning on the screen, it's still a 2D screen. And so what we've done with the printed models, we pull it out of the screen so that you can actually hold it in your hand and evaluate the anatomy sort of for the first time in a manner that makes sense and is logical.
Here's how it works. A CT scan, MRI, and other data are sent to a 3D printer to replicate a heart in a plaster or ceramic mold. The printer then constructs the heart thin layer by thin layer. Bramlett says the model matches the real heart in every detail.
When we're done with the model and we've made our decision, we want to be able to go back to the heart model or the source image and confirm those findings.
Bramlett has built model hearts for various procedures, all with successful outcomes. In one case, digital images showed a tiny hole in a baby's heart. Yet the 3D printed model revealed multiple holes, defects the baby was born with, and not readily apparent in the images.
Knowing that it was there, we could still not demonstrate it. And sure enough, he went in and was able to confirm it and change the surgery. But that saved ischemic time. Well, in the future, you know, relying on that information would allow us to, you know, not even have to stop the heart to sort of go down the alternative pathway.
Bramlett came to a recent American Heart Association meeting with a prop, a 3D printed baby's heart.
This is a very small, I mean, if you look at it, this is, you know, about the size of an egg. And this is the baby's heart. And to me, you know, I know the surgeons do amazing work, but when I sit here and I look and see this BT shunt and how small it is and how it's attached, it still baffles my mind that the surgeons are able to do the things that they do.
Kathy Magliato is a cardiac surgeon at St. John's Health Center in Los Angeles. Speaking by Skype, she said she welcomes the 3D model, saying it can help surgeons make better decisions before they operate.
The fact that I can then take this very complicated structure, which has just an endless possibilities of what it could look like anatomically when I open the body, and you give it to me before the operation, that I can hold it in my hand and plan an operation around what I'm seeing, touching, and feeling, that to me is what can potentially change the game on an operation and save lives.
Matthew Bramlett continues to explore the technology. He's partnered with the National Institutes of Health to build a 3D reference library that includes models and images that others can learn from. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Meanwhile, curators from the Smithsonian also used 3D printing to make a bust of President Barack Obama. Gunter Wabel is the Smithsonian's director of the Digitization Program Office. He said in a White House video that his crew was inspired by plaster life masks made of former President Abraham Lincoln.
And seeing that made us think, what would have happened if we could actually do that with a sitting president, using modern-day technologies and tools to create a similarly authentic experience that connects us to history, to connects us to a moment in time, and connects us to a person's likeness.
The bust is on display at the Smithsonian here in Washington. If you would like to learn more about that process, log on to www.whitehouse.gov and search 3D print. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
This is VOA Global from the Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman along with Jim Stevenson, and I have a brand new calendar for 2015, and you can too.
That's right. Our VOA 2015 calendar is out ahead of 2015. How about that? And you can get one for absolutely no cost. All you have to do is write to us, VOA Asia at voanews.com. Please include your complete, full postal mailing address. Otherwise, we can't get it to you. And if applicable, in your native language. And that way, it might get to you faster.
We check sports from the Voice of America. Real Madrid replaced Barcelona at the top of the Associated Press Global Football 10 Tuesday after extending its record run of wins to 20 in all competitions with 2 4-goal victories in a week. Madrid followed its 4-0 demolition of Ludogorets. Pardon me if I mess that up. My apology. In the Champions League with a 4-1 thrashing of Almeria on Friday to take the record tally of consecutive wins for a Spanish club to 20. Real had 2 members of its squad in the top 10 players this week, with Cristiano Ronaldo 3rd after scoring 3 times across the 2 games, and Gareth Bale 6th.
The Asian Football Confederation urged Australia Tuesday to provide extra security for next month's Asian Cup, following the siege at a Sydney cafe that left 2 hostages dead. The AFC asked organizers to beef up security at hotels and provide police escorts for training and matches during the tournament. That will be held in 5 Australian cities from January 9th through the 31st.
More and more we have these stories dealing in the sports world, but really are political or legal stories. Here's another one. The status of Russia and Qatar as World Cup host seemed even more secure Tuesday after FIFA dismissed ethics prosecutor Michael Garcia's appeal against the handling of his investigation into the bidding process. FIFA said its appeals panel ruled the case not admissible.
DeMarcus Beasley, the first American to play in 4 World Cups, says he's retiring from the U.S. national team after 14 years. The 32-year-old scored 17 goals in 121 international appearances and played in every minute of the Americans' 4 games at this year's World Cup, where the United States lost to Belgium in the second round.
Rory McIlroy has been chosen as the European Tour Player of the Year in golf, capping a season in which he won 2 majors, the Ryder Cup, and topped the money list in Europe and the United States. McIlroy, the world number one, won his maiden British Open title by 2 strokes over Ricky Fowler and Sergio Garcia at Royal Liverpool in July, and less than a month later earned a 2nd U.S. PGA championship at Valhalla, finishing a shot clear of Phil Mickelson. There you have it, a look at sports from the Voice of America.
This is VOA Global on the Voice of America. We take a look at music. On January 2nd, PBS stations throughout the United States will be airing a concert that Billy Joel recently performed in Washington, D.C. Joel was in Washington to receive a Gershwin Prize for popular song from the Library of Congress. Well, one of his most famous songs that we all know is Uptown Girl. Let's hear that. We have heard that was about his former wife, Christy Brinkley. Maybe.
Who still looks very good, unlike Billy. But Billy's doing okay. He's doing fine. More music news. Frank Sinatra's life and career is being made into a new free multimedia exhibition. Sinatra, an American Icon, will open at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts March of 2015. The exhibit will feature many artifacts from the Sinatra family's personal collection, including rare concert and interview footage, personal correspondence, private photographs, awards, and other memorabilia. And music and film documents from the library. 2015 marks the 100th anniversary of Sinatra's birth. Many events, exhibitions, new music, and film releases are planned throughout the year.
Well, that should be a great exhibition. Can't wait to see that. As we mentioned, Billy Joel here in Washington, D.C. to receive the Gershwin Prize. At the concert that they had, Tony Bennett was in attendance, along with Leanne Rimes, John Mellencamp, Gavin DeGraw, Boys to Men, among others. It's a TV special, of course. It'll be featuring special tributes filmed by Paul McCartney, James Taylor, and Barbara Streisand. Previous Gershwin Prize for popular song recipients include Paul Simon, Stevie Wonder, Paul McCartney, Carole King, also songwriters Hal David and Burt Bacharach, a who's who in the music industry.
Do you remember any of them? I hope so. That's music from the BOA. This is BOA Global from the Voice of America. Robin Williams' suicide seared into the world's collective mindset more than anything else this past year. That is based on what people are searching for on Google. The reaction to Williams' death in August topped Google's list of 2014's fastest rising search requests. It beat notable events like the World Cup, the Ebola outbreak, the March disappearance of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, and the Ice Bucket Challenge, an internet video craze to raise awareness and money for lateral sclerosis or Lou Gehrig's disease. Other topics of worldwide intrigue on Google included the addictive smartphone game Flappy Bird, bearded drag queen Conchita Wurst, the Middle East extremist group ISIS, the hit Disney movie Frozen, and the Winter Olympics in Russia.
Both were frozen.
I think so.
Well, you know, it happens this time each year. There was a mystery man handing out $100 bills, this time in Massachusetts. The generous mystery man made the holiday season a little bit brighter for employees of two Massachusetts coffee shops. A man wearing a cowboy hat walked into Mary Lou's in Hyannis on Saturday and handed the worker behind the counter 15 envelopes, each of them containing a crisp $100 bill. We were in the wrong place, Ira.
I've never seen this guy or anybody else handing out $100 bills. Why not? I have no idea.
Well, if I come across one, I'll split it with you. How's that?
That sounds real good. That's better than my offer to you.
Roll the credits.
That's gonna wrap up our program for today. Thank you for being with us on BOA Global. With Jim Stevenson, I am Ira Melman. Our thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our technical director, Zubir El-Tayeb, and our managing director, Diane Gao. Enjoy your day.
Bye.